For many people, just the sight of this substance causes anxiety, fear, sometimes even fainting. But without it, our bodies would be incapable of running. It is the life force of every animal that lives on the planet. I'm talking, of course, about blood. Blood is the most important bodily fluid we possess. It circulates around the body, carrying oxygen and other essential nutrients to the body's cells, while also carrying waste away from those cells. This waste is then carried down to two little organs about the size of your fist, called the kidneys. Kidneys work nonstop to filter out about 2 quarts of waste products and extra water from your blood every day. Those little guys get damaged, the body can't eliminate all that waste. All that waste builds up, the blood can become toxic, and eventually lead to coma and death. Now, one of the reasons the sight of blood can cause so much distress is because, for all intents and purposes, blood is supposed to stay inside your body. Seeing blood usually means something has gone terribly wrong. But if your blood can't be filtered inside the body, the only other option, obviously, is to filter it outside the body. Many patients with kidney failure go for a treatment called dialysis. The process of dialysis draws the blood out of the body, filters it, and then sends the clean blood back into the body. For a person with renal failure, it can be the difference between life and death. But what if the process that was designed to save your life is ultimately what causes your death? And what if the person you trusted your life with is ultimately the person who takes it? I'm Krista, and you're listening to episode 1 of Lone Star Law and Disorder. The area of the United States known as the Piney Woods covers a little less than 55,000 square miles that includes eastern Texas, northwest Louisiana, southwest Arkansas, and the southeast corner of Oklahoma. It's well known for its abundance of forests, rivers, lakes, fishing and wildlife, and of course, pine trees. Deep in the heart of the Piney Woods of East Texas lays Angelina County. Formed in 1846, it's the only county in Texas named for a woman. A Hassanai Indian woman who assisted early Spanish missionaries, who they named Angelina, or Little Angel. Eventually, her village became known as Angelina's Village, and the stream where it was located became known as Angelina's River. To this day, the Angelina River forms the boundary between Angelina County and Nacogdoches and St. Augustine counties. At the seat of Angelina County is Lufkin. The town of Lufkin is situated about 120 miles northeast of Houston and about 180 miles southeast of Dallas. As of the 2010 census, it accounts for over 35,000 of Angelina County's 86,711 residents, with the remaining population residing in smaller surrounding communities and unincorporated areas like Dyball, Hudson, and Pollock. It's seen some growth since then, but for the most part, there's still a calm to its rural lifestyle. No one ever would have known that this sleepy little town was home to a serial killer capable of pulling off the perfect murders. Well, almost. Given that Lufkin is the county seat, many people from all over the county come to Lufkin to receive a number of services. When DaVita Dialysis Clinic opened up in Lufkin, it served as a more central location for Angelina County residents in need of dialysis to receive their treatments. From 2003 through 2007, DaVita Dialysis Clinic in Lufkin, Texas, caught and held the eye of the Texas Department of State Health Services for a number of issues. Inspections over the years found problems with the used dialyzers, which are the filters, not being processed according to standards, and staff not being trained properly. In July of 2007, state inspectors found that DaVita didn't have the number of properly trained staff to meet the needs of the patients, and sometimes patients weren't even being given the correct treatments as ordered by their doctors. The inspector also witnessed the clinic run out of a mix used to treat the water, and the only person who knew how to mix the chemicals was the part-time biomedical technician that spent part of their time in another town about 45 minutes away. Now, it can't be said for sure that these problems contributed to a higher death toll at the Lufkin DeVita than what can be expected. But what can be said is that from January 1st through December 31st of 2007, 27 Lufkin DeVita patients died. Now, obviously, people with kidney failure are generally in worse health than much of the rest of the population, and some deaths can be expected. But the number of deaths at the Lufkin DeVita that year was 7.1% higher than the state average. By the end of March 2008, another 14 patients had died. Now, it's important to note that none of these deaths had occurred while receiving dialysis. The odds of a patient dying of cardiac arrest while hooked up to a dialysis machine is somewhere in the neighborhood of 7 in every 100,000. That's partly because dialysis patients receive constant monitoring by medical professionals. If the patient has a serious medical problem, their vital signs would show that before or sometime during the process. But during the month of April 2008, patients at DeVita of Lufkin began coding at an alarming rate. None of them started off with any problems. They started treatments without a hitch. Their complications began only after they had started their treatments, and they began suddenly and without warning, which was alarming to say the least. What threw DeVita into a full alarm were the events that occurred on April 1st of 2008, when one of the patients went into cardiac arrest near the end of her treatment and died. Employees would try to resuscitate her, but they would fail. It was the first death of its kind for everyone, but it wouldn't be the last, because within 5 minutes, a second patient would go into cardiac arrest and die in the middle of their treatment. Clara Strange was born Clara Jones on November 6, 1930 in Pollock, Texas. She grew up out in the country with five sisters and four brothers. She would go on to marry A.C. Strange and work for the Lufkin State School until her retirement. When her daughter died, she also raised her grandchildren. Ms. Strange was well-liked, and the DeVita employees sincerely enjoyed treating her. On April 1st, she was put on the dialysis machine at about 11:34 by patient care technician Whirlin Guillory. She had a little shortness of breath at the beginning of her treatment, but as her treatment progressed, she had greatly improved. Around 2:30 or 3, she was tolerating her treatment well. Her blood flow rate was set at 400 cc's per minute as prescribed by her doctor. Blood flow rate is crucial in dialysis. Obviously, too much blood can't be removed from the body at once, so usually no more than a pint of blood is outside the patient's body at one time. At this point, Mr. Guillory felt comfortable enough to go on his 30-minute break. It was when Mr. Guillory returned from his 30-minute break that he was in complete shock to find Miss Strange was unresponsive and without a heartbeat, and her blood flow rate had been lowered to 300 cc's per minute. A normal slowdown rate would have been something more like 400 cc's per minute to 390 cc's per minute. Nurses and doctors rushed to Miss Strange with the crash cart and attempted to revive her, but nothing worked. Miss Strange died right there in the clinic, still attached to the dialysis machine. Sixty-eight-year-old Thelma Metcalf of Zavala was another one of the well-liked patients. She was known as Fran to her friends. She raised four children and always made time for her friends in her church. In 2007, her health began to fail, so she was admitted to Memorial Medical Center in Lufkin with kidney problems. In August, after receiving treatments at the hospital, her condition had begun improving, so she was released from the hospital to continue her dialysis treatments at DeVita of Lufkin. But within a few days of beginning treatment there, her condition took a turn for the worse, and she was suddenly unable to walk. Her doctor told the family he didn't understand why she had gone downhill so fast. But even despite this, on April 1st, she was feeling great. Employees said she was talkative and her vital signs were on par. She began her treatment, coincidentally, in the same bay as Miss Strange. At 3:05 p.m., her blood pressure dropped from 105 over 82 to 93 over 68. her blood flow rate had also been turned down from 300 cc's a minute to 200 cc's a minute. She became unresponsive and her heart stopped beating. Ms. Metcalf was rushed to the hospital where EMTs administered 3 shots of epinephrine in an attempt to revive her. But it was too late. Ms. Metcalf became the second patient to die on the dialysis machine. Dr. Imran Nazir was the medical director for the Lufkin DeVita and had been a nephrologist for 23 years at the time. He would later say that he had never in his entire career seen a patient die of a heart attack while receiving dialysis. And he'd only ever heard of 2 such cases. The odds of what happened on April 1st, 2008 were astronomical. Now, the DeVita Corporation must have felt the heat from the fire under their butt because on April 2nd, 2008, they sent in a whole team that specialized in problems dealing with dialysis clinics. Their primary function was to find the problems that were affecting the patients at the Lufkin Dialysis Clinic, fix them, and fix them fast. The team was headed up by an RN named Amy Clinton. She took over full responsibility for the clinic on April 2nd. Everyone at the clinic thought it was something on site that was causing the problems. Ms. Clinton and her team started with the water purification system, since it's the biggest part of a dialysis clinic. They checked every aspect of the system, from the water itself down to the equipment. The water system had a built-in safeguard in the form of an alarm designed to alert everyone in the clinic if something was wrong in any aspect of the system. But they found nothing wrong with the purification system, the alarm system, or the water itself. Their next step was to check the biomedical technicians, who are responsible for mixing the chemicals used to treat the water that's used in the dialysis process. They reviewed the biotech's qualifications, work history, and all the paperwork that went with the job. The team then reviewed the reuse technicians and on-site processing area, where the filters that remove all the impurities from the blood are cleaned and sterilized and made ready for their next use. If you remember, back in 2007, there had been some problems in this area. But by the time Ms. Clinton and her team took over, those problems had been corrected. They then checked the dialysis machines themselves, but failed to find anything wrong with any of the machines. The team checked all of the clinic's policies and procedures to see if anything the technicians or nurses were doing might be a factor in killing or harming the patients. They looked at every procedure and could find nothing that can contribute to the fatalities and complications if the employees followed them all correctly. And all the documentation reviewed by the team suggested that they were. Lastly, the team looked at the patients themselves. Their patient records showed that none of them had begun their treatments with any problems. It was only after they started their treatments that problems would begin out of the blue. In the meantime, though, at least things had seemed to calm down. April 16th changed all that. Mr. Garland Kelly was born and grew up in segregated Lufkin. He lived in segregated neighborhoods and attended segregated schools all the way up through college. It took East Texas a long time to get on board with integration. The high school where Mr. Kelly had attended, Dunbar High, didn't integrate until 1970, and that was only because it was forced to do so by a federal court. Despite this, Mr. Kelly's friends said that Mr. Kelly never harbored any feelings of anger or ill will. His friends said that he always said it wasn't up to him to judge others. He couldn't control the way people felt, and it did him no good to worry about it. Mr. Kelly always said that he would let the Lord judge him on who he was and others on who they were. He was described as a kind man who never met a stranger. After marrying the love of his life and raising 3 girls who all graduated from college, at the age of 53, Mr. Kelly began to develop renal problems. He received a kidney transplant, but 3 years later, he had to start dialysis treatments. And he was no stranger to health problems. In addition to his kidney problems, Mr. Kelly was diagnosed with type 2 diabetes, COPD, and hypertension. He had developed severe gangrene in one leg, which forced the doctors to amputate it. But folks claim that Mr. Kelly never felt sorry for himself, or at least he never acted like it. In fact, people said that he was the one always trying to lift up the people around him. They also said if you weren't already aware of his health problems, you would never be able to tell by his actions and demeanor. People would often see this one-legged man outside his home raking his leaves all by himself. And that's the way he liked it. In the early morning of April 16, 2008, Mr. Kelly arrived for his treatment, carrying his usual boiled egg and grilled cheese to eat his snacks while he got his treatment. He was described as his normal, joking self. Mr. Kelly got hooked up to the dialysis machine at 5:36 a.m. with no indications from his vital signs that anything was wrong. He was resting comfortably by 7:30 a.m. At about 7:35 a.m., patient care technician Sharon Dearman was tending to another patient when she heard Mr. Kelly's alarm go off. She rushed over and found him unresponsive. She quickly clamped his lines and started CPR while someone else called for an ambulance. Mr. Kelly was still unconscious when EMTs arrived. He was rushed to the hospital, where he remained in a coma. Garland Kelly died 4 months later on August 15, 2008, without ever waking up. Graciela Castaneda also arrived at the clinic early that morning. Ms. Castaneda had been married for 40 years and raised 3 daughters. She had been a dialysis patient for 10 years already and felt fine that morning, no different than any other day. She sat quietly that morning as Mr. Kelly was rushed off to the hospital. At about 8 a.m., Ms. Castaneda was having a conversation with one of the female employees who was working on her lines when suddenly she passed out. Employees reacted immediately with the crash cart to revive Ms. Castaneda at 8:08 a.m. She was rushed to the hospital, where she was able to recover. What was most bothersome about Ms. Castaneda's situation was that on April 14th, Ms. Castaneda had her LDH levels tested. LDH stands for lactic acid dehydrogenase. Pay attention to this term, because it's going to come up again. LDH is an enzyme that's present in almost all the tissues in the body that helps produce energy, but it also becomes elevated in response to cell damage. On April 14th, Ms. Castaneda's LDH level measured at 219, totally within the normal range. But 20 minutes after her heart attack, her LDH level was 2,150. Employees at the clinic spent the next week reeling over what had just happened to Mr. Kelly and Ms. Castaneda, and they hadn't even fully recovered from the loss of Ms. Strange and Ms. Metcalf. But death would come calling again on April 23rd, 2008. Ms. Marie Bradley had graduated from Lufkin High School in 1948. She had worked at Jim Walter Homes for 25 years, working her way up through upper management. But in the year 2000, she began having heart and kidney problems and started dialysis at Woodland Heights Medical Center in Lufkin. On May 7, 2007, she began outpatient treatments at DaVita of Lufkin. Aside from requiring dialysis, Ms. Bradley's doctor actually described her as exceptional as far as health went. Unlike many of the other patients, she actually drove herself to and from her treatments. On April 23rd, as usual, Ms. Bradley drove herself in for her treatment and was hooked up to the dialyzer by 11 a.m. Her vital signs were good and she had no problems. That is until about 3:30 p.m., when her blood pressure suddenly plummeted and her oxygen levels dropped drastically. Ms. Bradley was rushed to the hospital, where she was fortunate enough to recover after being in a coma for 2.5 days. When she woke up, she had no idea what had happened. Like Ms. Castaneda, Ms. Bradley's LDH level had been tested several days prior and measured at 169, again well within the normal levels. At the hospital, it measured 1,372. On April 26th, around the time Ms. Bradley was waking up from her coma in the hospital, 94-year-old Cora Bryant was arriving at the Lufkin DaVita for her scheduled treatment. Ms. Bryant was born in San Augustine, Texas in 1943. She settled in Lufkin, married, and raised her 4 daughters and 1 son. She loved her kids and her grandchildren and was described as always being able to make people laugh. The day before her treatment, Ms. Bryant had taken a walk with her granddaughter, where she told her granddaughter, "I feel good. Come on, keep up." Ms. Bryant's daughters described her as having a will to never give up. On April 26th, LVN Candace Lackey hooked Ms. Bryant up to the dialysis machine. She had a few clotting problems at the beginning of her treatment, but they changed her lines out and everything resolved itself. Ms. Bryant was resting comfortably by the time Ms. Lackey decided to go on her 30-minute break. When Ms. Lackey came back from her break, though, she found another technician resetting the alarm on Ms. Bryant's machine, but Ms. Bryant herself seemed to be fine. Because of the clotting problems earlier in the treatment, though, Miss Lackey checked Miss Bryant's bloodlines for clotting just in case. Everything looked clear, so Miss Lackey set the machine to return Miss Bryant's blood to her body. Most people wouldn't know this, but most dialysis patients say that each different medication given through their blood while on dialysis has a different taste, and this medication tasted different. Within seconds of Miss Bryant's blood being returned to her body, Miss Bryant asked Miss Lackey what she had given her. Miss Bryant then turned her head to the side, and just like that, her heart stopped. Miss Bryant was rushed to the hospital in a coma and never woke up. Cora Bryant died on July 15, 2008. Only a few years younger than Miss Bryant was fellow patient Miss Opal Few. At 91 years young, Miss Few was still full of life and in better shape than most of the other patients. She was described as a tiny silver-haired lady with a big personality. In fact, it was said that when Miss Few came into a room, people knew she was there. Miss Few was born in Pollock, Texas, and attended Central ISD until she graduated. She married and began running a boarding house in Lufkin for many years. Most people described her as compassionate and giving. Even into her later years, Miss Few led a really independent lifestyle, doing all of her own cooking and cleaning and taking care of her daughter's 10 and 12-year-old children after school. Her doctor described her as lively and full of energy and spirit. Almost everyone described her this way. The employees at DaVita described her as a dream patient because she was always so cheerful and full of life. And April 26th was no different. Miss Few had originally been scheduled to come in that afternoon, but due to some cancellations, she received a call asking her if she'd like to come in earlier. She jumped at the chance. Elvie and Danya Hartsfield described Miss Few as just a sweet little lady, happy and cheerful and excited to be able to get in early. Miss Hartsfield hooked Miss Few to the dialysis machine and monitored her vital signs, which were good. Miss Few was still progressing well when Miss Hartsfield asked a coworker to watch her patients while she was on break. When Miss Hartsfield left out for her break, everything was fine. When she returned from that break, everything had flipped on its head. Miss Few was unresponsive and without a pulse. Miss Few became the fifth person in 26 days to die on the dialysis machine. So imagine witnessing all of this. One patient gets rushed to the hospital near death, and the other dies right in front of your eyes. Now, imagine witnessing all of that happen while those patients were hooked up to the same machine you are. That was the experience of Deborah Oates. Miss Oates had been a dialysis patient since 2005. Her treatments had become totally routine. On April 26th at around 10:30 a.m., after having witnessed what happened to Miss Bryant and Miss Few, Miss Oates was sitting quietly watching television when one of the technicians came over to administer her medications. Like Miss Bryant, Miss Oates was familiar with all the tastes and sensations that go along with dialysis. While the technician administered her medication through her bloodline, Miss Oates tasted something strange. She asked the technician, "What are you giving me?" The technician hadn't even answered yet when suddenly Miss Oates' access point, where she was hooked up to the dialysis machine, began to bleed and wouldn't stop. Miss Oates' blood pressure dropped. She was overcome with nausea and began vomiting. Her whole body was in pain. She began sweating excessively and couldn't breathe, and it felt like her chest would explode. Her blood pressure had dropped from 147 over 73 to 83 over 56. Employees were able to get Miss Oates immediately into an ambulance and rush her to the hospital. Miss Oates, unlike the others that day, survived. For the next few days, the mood had changed so much you could feel it in the air. Nonetheless, the employees at DaVita, and especially their patients, had no choice but to go on with business as usual. But business would be anything but usual. On April 28, 2008, Ms. Marva Roan and Carolyn Reisinger arrived for their usual treatments early in the morning. Patient care technician Angie Rodriguez hooked Ms. Roan up to the dialysis machine close to 6 a.m. Ms. Roan had a slight drop in her blood pressure near the beginning of the treatment, but it wasn't at a level that would cause concern. By 8 a.m., Ms. Roan and Ms. Reisinger were doing well, and Ms. Rodriguez felt comfortable to take her 30-minute break. She returned after only 15 minutes to find that Ms. Roan's blood pressure had gone up. She seemed agitated and uncomfortable, and Ms. Reisinger was also complaining of pressure in her chest and stomach pain. The majority of dialysis patients say that dialysis treatment itself is painless. Some patients may experience a drop in their blood pressure, which can cause some nausea, vomiting, headache, or cramps. But with frequent treatments, though, those problems usually go away. Carolyn Reisinger had experienced all of these before. But what she felt on April 28th was different. At approximately 8:15 a.m., Ms. Roan began to feel enormous pressure in her chest and complained of severe stomach pain. It felt like she was going to die. Thankfully, DaVita employees were able to stabilize both Ms. Roan and Ms. Reisinger, and as quickly as their symptoms started, they passed. No one could figure out what was going on at the DaVita clinic in Lufkin. Not the employees, not the specialized team, and not the nephrologists. But they were about to find out. DaVita patient Linda Hall had worked in and around the medical field for a large part of her career. She worked as a nursing assistant until her failing health had caused her to leave. Ms. Hall had been reading quietly while undergoing her usual treatment when she just happened to look up. She didn't know exactly what made her look up, but when she did, one of the nurses caught her attention. Ms. Hall watched the nurse open a drawer, remove a syringe, and put it in her shirt pocket. Normally, this probably wouldn't have even held Ms. Hall's attention at all. But it wasn't the nurse's actions so much as how she was acting while she was doing it. As Ms. Hall continued to watch, she noticed that the nurse's behavior was increasingly odd. Ms. Hall watched as the nurse looked around very carefully, almost as if to see if anyone was looking at her. She also did this when she set a bleach bucket on the floor. In a sterilized healthcare facility, nothing involving patient care is supposed to touch the floor. So seeing the nurse do this was odd to Ms. Hall. Ms. Hall watched the nurse squat down beside the bleach bucket. She again looked around very carefully. Ms. Hall then watched as the nurse inserted the syringe from her shirt pocket into the bleach bucket, filled it with bleach, and returned to the nursing station. After a few minutes, Ms. Hall watched the nurse walk over to Marva Roan's station, which again wouldn't have been at all out of the ordinary had the nurse's behavior not been so odd. Ms. Hall watched the nurse look around the clinic again very carefully to see if anyone was watching, all while completely oblivious to the fact that Ms. Hall was watching her every move. Ms. Hall then watched in horror as the nurse took the syringe that she had filled with bleach and injected it into Ms. Roan's saline port. Still confused as to exactly what was happening, Ms. Hall watched as the nurse continued right on over to Carolyn Reisinger and injected a syringe into her lines as well. The nurse then walked away as if nothing was out of the ordinary and dropped the syringes into two Sharps containers. Ms. Hall couldn't believe what she had just seen. But she wasn't the only one that saw. Lurleen Hamilton was from Chirino, Texas. She spent her career working in a nursing home and an MHMR center taking care of the elderly. Ms. Hamilton had been receiving dialysis for about 8 years. People would describe her later as an especially observant patient, and this characteristic was never more appreciated than on April 28th. Ms. Hamilton also watched the nurse cross the bay to Ms. Roan and Ms. Reisinger's stations. She too watched as the nurse looked around as if to see if anyone else was looking at her. She then watched as the nurse kneeled beside a bleach bucket she put on the floor. In her 8 years of dialysis, and in all of her years in the medical field, she'd never seen a medical professional put something used in treatment on the floor. Ms. Hamilton continued watching as the nurse drew bleach into the four syringes and put them in her pocket. The nurse never saw Ms. Hamilton watching as she injected both Ms. Roan and Ms. Reisinger's dialysis lines with bleach. Ms. Hamilton couldn't move. She was still as she watched the employees attend to the adverse reactions Ms. Roan and Ms. Reisinger had to the injections. She was normally a really quiet person. But as Ms. Roan and Ms. Reisinger were stabilized, Ms. Hamilton began frantically looking around for someone, anyone that she could trust to tell what she'd just seen. Because the nurse she'd just seen injecting Ms. Roan and Ms. Reisinger was the same nurse that was covering for her. That nurse was Kimberly Clark Sines. Kimberly Clark Sines was born Kimberly Clark Fowler on November 3, 1973. She attended Central ISD in Pollock, Texas. She never really got into any trouble, but she never really seemed to excel either. She never quite seemed to fit in, and she didn't really leave an impression on anyone. She participated in some sports like softball, but never really tried that hard to succeed. In eighth grade, she gave cheerleading a go and participated in some UIL events. But by her sophomore year, she'd quit cheerleading and was only half-heartedly participating in the Central Junior Varsity softball team. That year, though, things changed for Kim. She got involved with a senior by the name of Chris Hopper. Chris was popular and smart. He was voted most spirited and most likely to succeed by his class. He played basketball and baseball all 4 years of high school. He was on the student council and yearbook and a member of the National Honor Society. He was everything that Kim was not. Chris graduated in 1990, and the two continued to date. In 1991, before she started her senior year at Central, Kim gave birth to a son by Chris. Instead of going back to school, she married Chris Hopper and settled into life as a mother. Now, that marriage only lasted 6 years and ended in divorce in October of 1997. After the divorce was final, Kim went to work for Fleetwood Transportation Services in Dibal, Texas, which is about 10 miles outside of Lufkin. She was still working at Fleetwood in September of 1999 when she suddenly became very sick. She was rushed to the hospital and diagnosed with pneumonia. Kim was so bad off that the local hospital wasn't able to provide a treatment aggressive enough, so she had to be transported to Methodist Hospital in Houston. Kim later told friends that she considered it a near-death experience, and that was when she truly became a Christian. She was putting her faith in the Lord, who would take care of things from there. Shortly after her self-proclaimed near-death experience, Kim met a man at Fleetwood Transportation by the name of Kevin Sines. Kevin had only recently moved to Angelina County from the Houston area. It seems that Kevin and the law didn't really get along in Houston. He'd been arrested for and pled guilty to two felonies. He spent 4 years in the Texas prison system and moved in with his mother in Angelina County when he was paroled in August of 1998. After a whirlwind romance, Kim became pregnant by Kevin. The two married on June 10, 2000, and Kim quit her job at Fleetwood on June 23, 2000. Kimberly Clark Fowler was now Kimberly Clark Sines. On December 22, 2000, Kim Sines gave birth to a daughter. She spent the next year and a half as a stay-at-home mom, but in 2002, Kim decided it was time for a change. In August of 2002, she began the nursing program at Angelina College in Lufkin. She graduated in December 2004 as a licensed vocational nurse, or an LVN, in Texas, and went to work almost straight away at Memorial Hospital in Lufkin. That job lasted only 5 months. A month after she left Memorial Hospital, Kim went to work at a second hospital in Lufkin, Woodland Heights. But 2 months into her job at Woodland Heights, she was fired for stealing Demerol. These charges were reported to the Texas State Board of Nursing. However, the State Board of Nursing only lists the allegation against a nurse's license after the charges have been investigated. By the time she got a new job at Right Choice Home Health, the nursing board had not yet investigated the charges from Woodland Heights, so she still had a clear nursing record for potential employers to look at. Her stint at Right Choice only lasted for 2 months. Co-workers said she initially really seemed to enjoy the work and was very pleasant. But her mood and overall disposition took a sharp turn for the worse very soon into her employment. She was let go by the company for constantly being late without calling in. Sometimes she just didn't even show up for work. And when she did show up, she was sullen and depressed. It was at this point that her husband Kevin decided she needed professional help. He took his wife to Brentwood Hospital in Shreveport, Louisiana, where she was admitted for depression and suicidal thoughts. After a short stay at Brentwood, Kim returned to Lufkin and applied at the Lufkin State School. She was hired on October 1, 2006, but she was terminated only 30 days later on October 31st as being unsuitable for her assigned position, whatever that means. Kimberly Clark Sines had been a nurse for less than a year and had been through four jobs and now had four no rehires on her record. But the nursing board still hadn't gotten around to investigating those charges yet. So on November 27, 2006, she began working at the Children's Clinic of Lufkin. After working there for about 6 months, she was reprimanded for missing work for more than 8 days without calling in. That reprimand apparently fell on deaf ears because the clinic had to terminate Kim on May 29, 2007. During this time, Kim and Kevin had been in some real financial trouble in addition to Kim's depression, all of which was putting a huge strain on their marriage. In June of 2007, Kim and Kevin separated. Following their split, police were called to respond to a disturbance on Two-Lane Drive in Lufkin, and Kim was arrested for assault causing bodily injury. The story goes that Kim and Kevin had gotten into a big argument at their home in Pollock, and Kevin left the home to come to his mother's house in Lufkin. Kim had followed him there and initiated a physical altercation in which Kevin was injured. She spent the night in jail and was released the next day, only to find that Kevin had filed for an emergency magistrate's protective order against her. Even after all that drama, somewhere between June and August of 2007, Kim and Kevin seemed to work things out, at least for the time being. And still, the State Board of Nursing had not gotten around to investigating that charge from Woodland Heights. So in August of 2007, Kimberly Clark Sines was hired for her sixth job since becoming a nurse in December 2004 as a licensed vocational nurse at DaVita Dialysis Clinic in Lufkin. And in only 7 months, it would be Kimberly Clark Sines that put DaVita Dialysis Clinic and the city of Lufkin on the map. At approximately 4 p.m. on April 28th, Sergeant Stephen Abbott of Lufkin Police Department's Criminal Investigation Division received word that he needed to go to DaVita to check out possible issues with tampering of medicine.
I'm Stephen Abbott, and I'm Sergeant with the Lufkin Police Department. I've been working here for 26 years now. During my time here, I've worked patrol, narcotics, I've worked criminal investigations and community policing. I'd been advised by one chief that there was a problem with tampering with medicine. I'd been advised by the other chief that there was a problem with one of the patients there, which required a criminal investigation.
Sergeant Abbott asked Corporal Mike Shirley, now Lieutenant Shirley, to come along for the ride.
Not knowing what I was getting into, I found Mike standing in the hallway and said, "Hey, you're it," and off we went.
Mike Shirley, I'm a lieutenant of Lufkin PD. I've been here 23 years. Started out my career in die ball and as a reserve officer, and then came to work here in 95. Initially, when he grabbed me in the hall, we had no idea what we were fixing to walk into. We were met by the director of that unit as well as attorneys for DaVita, and they gave us a real quick rundown about what happened. Of course, they had their legal counsel there, monitoring kind of what all was said. They kind of wanted to tell us what happened, but not, say too much, I guess.
They kind of put the cart before the horse in that they started with, over the past month, there had been a series of cardiac incidences at the facility. They gave us names and a little bit of background on each one of them, the victims. And then kind of as a, by the way, we had this happen again today, and two of our patients witnessed it, and this is the person who did this. And that's kind of where they left it right there as, okay, we've given you all this information, all this evidence. Now, y'all figure out what you're going to do with it.
They did go into a little bit of, of what they did before trying to figure out what happened. Like, they thought it might be a problem with the heparin medication, so they had, tried to rule that out, which they did. There were some things that they had done trying to figure out what happened and weren't able to really figure it out, so they just kind of passed the ball to us. We got a tour, basically, of the inside of the facility. Neither one of us had been in there before. I didn't know what the inside of a dialysis clinic looked like. They gave us a kind of a crash course on how the machines worked and all that. Kind of showed us the area where it all allegedly happened. But we just started documenting, what was there, taking pictures and the layout, where everything was kept and all that. Then we were like, what do we need to get, And so we had talked about they'd brought up the heparin. So I said, well, let's get the heparin.
There had previously been a bad batch of a blood thinner called heparin that had been recalled.
And there was some information that, she had disposed of these syringes in the Sharps containers. So we obviously wanted to get those Sharps containers, but after talking with Steve, I was like, we're going to get some of them. Let's get them all. That way nothing can be said later that we only tested these and not others. And that, I think, turned out to be very important.
We were both concerned with being spoon-fed all this stuff. Like I said, initially, there was a little bit of disbelief on our part. And I think that whenever the officials from DaVita came to us and said, hey, we did all of this, and here's what you need to take, we kind of stepped back and said, yeah, we'll take that, but we're going to take this, 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 and this, too. A lot of it at the time we took it, we really didn't have a clue what we were going to do with it, but we figured we only get one shot at it. We're better off taking it now than figuring out we need it later.
Another thing they had done was kept the bloodlines from people that had incidences, and so we said, okay, we're going to take them too.
Sergeant Abbott and Corporal Shirley decided to pay a visit to Kim Sines. Detectives wanted to get her version of events. Detectives located Ms. Sines at her home in Pollock. She agreed to come in for questioning. Kim said she would just ride in with the detectives if they'd give her a minute to grab her purse and take care of something inside the house. As time on the clock ticked on, detectives started wondering what was taking Kim so long inside the house. Once they arrived at the station, it was time to get down to business and find out what the hell was going on at DaVita.
And how do you pronounce your last name?
Sines, S-A-E-N-Z. And I went to A&E Angelina Nursing School. I went into Woodland Heights Medical Center doing med surg, and it was just too much for me. And I had a friend of mine that asked me to come, you know, just to see what dialysis was like. And the first, I don't know, 6 or 8 months, it was going fine.
And you had somebody watching you during that time. How did you do then?
She said I did excellent. That was Miss, I can't remember her. I can see her. But she stood right behind me. She said I had good techniques.
During the interview, Science tried to offer her own explanation.
I have noticed lately that there's been a lot of sloppiness. But I just wonder about the blood pressures, you know, when they come in and they're really high. I get so scared they're going to stroke out. We just had so many chest pains that I just don't understand. And they said we've had so many deaths, and it's just scary, and I'm scared to leave my patients. But I don't know what's going on. I don't know. It's just for freezing because, I mean, it's just, I just don't know. I feel like, you know, I feel like I'm doing everything in the power I can. And I've been looking up on the inner line, like, what am I doing wrong? And I'm just curious what if our machines are hooked up and they have some leech in them. I haven't researched into that, but I just have to wonder what kind of reactions would have happened if there was some leech machines, you know, not clear.
There were a few things that came up during the interview that did raise concerns. I mean, the first one to mention bleach was her.
In trying to explain her actions that day, Signs put the bleach in her own hands. And oddly enough, it was Signs that mentioned doing internet searches, and it was Signs who brought up the concern that bleach may have been the cause of some of the incident.
You also had the issue of she actually fessed up to filling a syringe with bleach.
Yeah. Which and we putting expected, it on the floor, right, which was a big no-no.
We expected a complete denial there.
Can you tell us anything about the bleaching procedures?
Bleaching procedures? We are supposed to, some people do it before you get your, there's two things in bleach back there, and it's either before or after, but you have to get your bleach bowl, and you have to get like a little medicine cup, and you got to go all the way back there, and you got to get that, and you pour it in your bowl. And that's your sponges to wipe up.
Do you use a syringe to pull your 10 cc's of bleach up?
Sometimes I do when I can't find the little medicine cups. Mm-hmm. They used to be in that trap drawer. There weren't any in there. So I knew 10 cc's would make that. But if you use a syringe, 10 cc's, then you're going to have to, you know, put it in the receptacle.
Okay, did you do that yesterday at all? Did you draw any bleach up in a syringe?
She tried to explain that she had used the syringes to measure the bleach so she could make the proper cleaning solution.
I drew, I had two that I went back there for. And I put the 2LM in the bleach, and then I took another one up there that said clean clamp. I put it there. I put the 2 mLs, whatever, in there, and I set the clamp, and I set my bleach. So then I put my rags in my bleach, and I put my clean clamps in there, which is something I'm trying to get used to, too.
Did anything happen yesterday out of the ordinary?
The only thing I noticed, like on my side and Christy's side, Miss Rome's venous chamber was clutting off. I mean, it had big cluts in it. And I asked her if she felt okay. She said okay. So I gave her a little bit of saline to try to get that It was like a monstrous clot in there. But what hurts me the most is for two patients to accuse me of giving another patient medication that was not ordered.
As the interview progressed, Kim's functioning declined.
Kim, do you have any type of medical problems yourself?
No, I do take depression once a day. I take Cymbalta once a day.
She became more and more incoherent and rambled about information that hadn't been asked for.
I want to draw all my meds so I know where they're coming from. I don't want to shoot something up there that I don't know what it is, because that's just right there at the heart, and if you do it, then, you know, it's so hard because you think, what am I doing?
Do you want to just turn that off?
Yeah, I did.
It was time to close it down.
You know, she made several comments and statements during that interview that had we known then what she was talking about, it could have taken, of course, she obviously ate a bunch of Xanax or something before the interview, because she was pretty coherent for a little while and then she pretty quickly dropped off. So I think had we been able to have an honest, sober, intelligent interview with her, things could have maybe been more productive.
Detectives had initially been a little disbelieving and took the story with a grain of salt. But after talking with the people at DaVita, and especially after the interview with Kim Sines, they were still uncertain about exactly what happened, but they were taking the allegations much more seriously. Other evidence began to emerge almost immediately. Right around the time all this was happening, Kevin Sines was pursuing a divorce. Detectives got a call from an attorney's office. Kevin Sines was there, and he had something to share. Kevin told police that he had gone by the house to do some work on the computer. It was then that he noticed some concerning internet searches.
At the time, the attorney that he went and talked to was our city attorney, and he called over here and said, hey, Kevin Sines is in my office. He wants to talk to him. So Steve called me, and he said, hey, get over to Flournoy's office now. Kevin's over there and wants to talk. And I was like, okay. Because I think he was a little, well, he seemed to be, you know, supportive of her at first. Then all of a sudden, now he's wanting to talk with us. But that was kind of a bombshell that he dropped then about her. You know, he looked at the computer and looked at the search history and saw what all she was looking up and everything. And, you know, they were going through some problems. So I think his motivation at the time was to, you know, to get his daughter. So, yeah, I mean, he said that there were searches on there relating to bleach. Can bleach be detected in blood?
Another search related to hemo something. Yeah. He didn't remember what, that started off with hemo. Just things which he thought were outside the normal scope of what she would have been looking at as part of her treatment. Things which led him to believe that there was a possibility she'd been involved in some of the accident to be there.
After we talked to him, it became pretty evident that we needed to get that computer. So then we started working on putting together a search warrant to go and seize the computer to get it analyzed as well.
A forensic analysis of that computer would later reveal some very damning evidence for Kim. But of those searches, the most damning would be specifically, can bleach be detected in bloodlines? It was CSU Christy Pate that found the first big break in the case.
What we did is we kind of followed the example that DaVita set for us. They initially said that they tested the syringes with test strips for the presence of chlorine. Well, these test strips are like what you use for your pool test strip. They turn purple whenever they're exposed to chlorine. So we took all of their test strips and we tested all the syringes using those test strips. So it was kind of like a field test for it, like what we do with cocaine, you know. We couldn't say definitively it was chlorine. We couldn't say definitively it was bleach. But we could say that the positive reaction was indicative of the presence of bleach, if that makes sense.
We brought all these sharps containers back, and we had our crime scene tech, Christy Pate. She was going through testing syringes. She ended up getting a sharps container that contained Opal Fuse syringes, and those were syringes that I think, what were the 10 cc syringes were what she had drawn up.
She had used a 10cc syringe for on the day that she was observed. Whenever Christy was checking the syringes, the Sharps containers, she located a 3-milliliter syringe, which should have contained Zemplar, which is a medicine commonly used in dialysis.
It's a much smaller syringe. It wasn't one that was laying around in the facility or anything. I mean, not where she was said to have gotten the other ones anyway.
And it actually had Opal's name on it. It had the date on it. The date was 4/26/08, and that was the date Opal died. That was the date she was murdered. We found that, found the barrel was positive. The barrel of the syringe was positive for bleach. Now, the way it was found, you know, there's a plunger in a syringe, and that plunger was pushed all the way to the bottom, so it trapped whatever was in there. Whenever we pulled the plunger out and ran the little test strip in there, just like you would when you pull it, turned purple, which means there was chlorine in there. There was no way for it to have gotten in there otherwise. Took that syringe, which was labeled with Zemplar, with Opal's name and the date, went back and looked at Opal's records, and lo and behold, Opal was administered Zemplar on April 26th, and the person administering it by record was Kim Sines. There's no excuse. She couldn't have never, ever have used that to measure bleach because that was only supposed to contain Zemplar. So there's no reason for bleach to be in there. And yet here it is, and she's the one who administered it. And as soon as she administered it, Opal Few went into cardiac arrest. To me, that's as damning as you can get. That was the point. She's done it. Now what are we going to do about it? We had concerns about possible murder charges. We had concerns about what to charge her with. One of the things Clyde asked of us before we could charge anybody with murder is we needed to have some expert that could say what effect bleach would have on you that would kill you. Now, that sounds like a pretty easy question to answer, but whenever you actually talk to doctors, we had a real hard time finding any of them that would be willing to stand and testify and say bleach will kill you. Bleach is made up of sodium hypochlorite, and chlorides are naturally occurring in your body, so it's really hard to test for that as being part of the blood or the makeup of somebody's body chemistry. There is no specific test whenever you get in the hospital like there is for arsenic. You can say this person received arsenic. Can't do that with bleach. Until this case, about mid-case, there was no test to document whether somebody had been exposed to chlorine. So it was a challenge all the way around. A good way to describe it would be these chlorine chloridates occur in your blood naturally. And who's to say you just don't have an overly high level of them? So they had to develop a test which could quantify the amount in your system and say that it came from an external source, which took some doing.
But how do you detect something that's undetectable?
We started off with probably one of the leading experts on product tamperings, the Food and Drug Administration. So we reached out to them, and they sent an agent down here. We told him what we had, what we suspected. He put us in touch with their forensic lab in Ohio, and we talked with them. The Ohio lab said they'd never really tested for something like this before, but they've tested for product tampering or contamination bleach. So it shouldn't be much different, and they were willing to give it a try. They did some experimenting. They finally said, yes, we believe we can tell if bleach has been present in the bloodline. So we started off with the two patients, Ms. Ronan and Ms. Reisinger, who were observed by Ms. Hall and Hamilton receiving bleach on the 28th. We sent those bloodlines in. We also sent in the syringes that the witnesses said she used. And we kind of did a dry run with it. Let's see what we get. And they were able to confirm that those did have bleach in. So from that point, we began to ship off more and more. And then the test got more and more zeroed in on what we were trying to find out. Initially, they could say it was an oxidizing agent. Ultimately, they were able to refine the test to the point where they could say it was sodium hypochlorite. So as time went on, they did more tests, more research, made better tests. Luckily, whenever DaVita called us on the initial call, they also reached out to the state health department and to the Centers for Disease Control, and they advised that there was possibly some sort of medical problem. So the Centers for Disease Control and the state health department sent down what they call an epidemiology team. And what they do is they try to locate the source of any contamination or any outbreak or any medical issue. That team arrived on the ground probably April the 30th, 2008, and what they did is they began to correlate medical records. We talked with them, and they said that they would help us to a degree. They would give us the results of their investigation, but they wouldn't necessarily tell us those things we could use in court, if that makes sense. They began to do a full-blown epidemiology investigation, and what that does is they look at all the patients at the facility for the past year, every aspect of their treatment, every aspect of their outcomes.
They also begin to test all the water sources, because that's pretty relevant in dialysis. They begin to test all the medicine for any contamination. And they also begin to work up stats on everybody who worked there, when they were there, when they weren't, things like that, to see if there was any correlation between this person being here and these events happening. One of the things they did at the initial, the doctor who was in charge of it, Michael Schwartz, requested that they gather blood samples from patients of DaVita, patients of other dialysis clinics, and then persons who had no kidney problems, no issues and needed dialysis, so that they could test those, see if there was any commonalities between the three groups. Dr. Schwartz had discovered a doctor in North Carolina who was doing some cutting-edge research on chlorine exposure. He believed he had developed a test which could tell if someone had been exposed to chlorine by measuring the amount of tyrosine, chlortyrosine actually, in their system. Chlortyrosine is a combination of chlorine and tyrosine, which is an amino acid in your blood. Whenever chlorine is introduced into your blood system, it bonds with that tyrosine, making chlortyrosine.
Detectives sent equipment from the clinic for testing, including the lines which would have been contaminated if Science had injected the intravenous lines.
So they took those samples and sent them off to the doctor, blind. They scrubbed all the names off of them, assigned them reference numbers, kept the key to the reference numbers down here. Only one person had it, and said, okay, who do you think has been exposed to chlorine based upon these samples? He was able to correctly identify people we suspected had been exposed and rule out people we hadn't.
Results from that study showed that every single sample from a victim showed traces of bleach, while not one of the other random samples showed any.
His test discovered 9 or 10 blood samples of people he decided had been exposed. Well, those just happened to be people who suffered attacks at DaVita. Also, one of the neat things about it, whenever a hospital admits you and takes a blood draw, they hold on to that draw for a couple of weeks. Even whether you're dismissed or whatever, they still hold on to that draw. Part of the thing that the epidemiology team was able to do was to go back and locate those blood draws from 2 or 3 weeks ago and ship those off too. So we were able to correlate, even though DaVita didn't save the evidence, the hospital did. We were able to correlate the blood test on Cora Bryant from her date of admission, which I believe was 4/16, and say that whenever she was admitted, blood was drawn and she had been exposed to chlorine sometime during that day. Then we were able to go back and track her medical records for that day, see everybody who handled her. Also, because of the diligence of our crime scene techs and Mike and I talking, whenever we took those sharps containers from each station, we made a good map of where they had been, who, what machines they were next to. We were able to correlate the seat that Cora Bryant sat on the 16th with the sharps container that should have been next to her. And lo and behold, there was a 10 mil syringe that was positive bleach in that sharps container.
Yeah, this was literally like someone, if this were a solid table, walking in here and dumping out a million piece jigsaw puzzle. And, you know, first thing you got to do is flip over all the pieces. But as pieces start coming together, you know, eventually you get the full picture. But it was a daunting task.
As time went on, they started putting more of the pieces together. In the meantime, Corporal Shirley was responsible for some good old-fashioned detective work and put boots on the ground to go get individual witnesses interviewed. For Shirley, it was really only then that what had really happened at DaVita of Lufkin in April of 2008 became clear to him. Both eyewitnesses individually talked and described what they had seen, and their stories independently matched very well.
After I talked to those two ladies, I felt very strongly. I believe what they said. And these were just two little sweet ladies. You know, they didn't have any reason to want to lie about anything or nothing to gain, you know, so they were very credible. But after talking with them, I was like, she did it. If she did those, she probably did the other ones, but we still had to prove it. Yeah, that was one of the things, like, we just kind of divided up some stuff early on. And one of my main jobs was doing the interviews. I interviewed everybody that worked there, every single person, one at a time. And I kind of developed a set line of questions that I asked every single one of them. And some of those questions were, what do you think happened? You know, who do you think could have done? If not Kim, can you give me, you know, point me in another direction? Or is there any explanation, you know, things along that line? And, you know, nobody else could come up with anything.
As the interviews progressed, Kim's coworkers started getting some of that 20/20 hindsight that's always so clear after the fact. Mr. Guillory reported that when Miss Strange was crashing, he had yelled to Kim, "Kim, what's going on?" Kim never answered him. In fact, she didn't even seem to care.
There was a couple of times right where patients would code and everybody's running over there to help them but her. Then everybody there is, "Oh my God, what do I need to do to help?" But not her.
Corey Smith, the patient care technician who had rushed the crash cart out for Miss Metcalf, later reported that he handed Kim the breathing bag and she placed it over Miss Metcalf's mouth and started operating the breathing bag while another nurse performed chest compressions. But Smith began to notice that there was no rise and fall in Miss Metcalf's chest, which meant she wasn't getting any oxygen in her lungs. Smith reported that he told Kim that she needed to open up Miss Metcalf's airway, but she didn't respond. Smith told her two or three more times, but she never even acknowledged that he was talking to her. Smith ended up yanking the breathing bag from Kim and attempting to clear Miss Metcalf's airway himself.
One of the patient care techs he worked with her said it best. Even whenever she, because there was a particular patient that had coded that day and Kim had been assigned as a person to bag her, which is, you're supposed to squeeze the bag and it gives them oxygen, keeps them. And Kim was not doing it properly. I mean, there's not much to it. You squeeze it back, but you still managed to not do that to the point where the other patient care tech noticed it. So her behavior was not consistent with what it should have been. It was more cold or uncaring, going through the motions.
Miss Dearman recalled that when Mr. Kelly's alarm went off and she had turned around to see what was going on, it was Kim that she saw trying to reset the alarm. Dearman and another RN also recalled that they had seen something in Mr. Kelly's bloodline that they'd never seen before. It looked like a really unusual blood clot, but it looked fibrous, almost like hair.
There were witnesses that said that there were times where they saw the line and it would go from red to almost a black, tarry looking, you know, it would stop up the machine and everything.
Several months after Miss Castaneda's cardiac incident, she saw a picture of Kim Zine in the newspaper and pointed it out to her daughter as being the woman she had been talking to right before she lost consciousness. It had been Kim Zine that administered the medication to both Miss Bradley and Miss Oates when they asked what she'd given them, and Kim had never answered them, just walked off. Elvie and Candace Lackey recalled that it was Kim Zine she had found trying to reset Cora Bryant's alarm when she came back from break and immediately before she had set the machine to return Miss Bryant's blood to her body. While Miss Bryant was coding, another RN recalled that Kim had literally just stood there, watching while everyone else rushed out to help. She never even attempted to give Miss Bryant CPR. It had been Kim Zine who administered medications to Miss Few on the day she died, but she hadn't even documented it until someone instructed her to. In addition to all that hindsight, time records also showed that the 10 occurrences that happened on 6 different days had one big thing in common. Kimberly Science was the only employee that worked on all 6 of those days. With forensic evidence growing by the day, eyewitnesses, and the incriminating internet searches, it was time to go to court. Kimberly Clark Science was arrested on May 30th, 2008. A grand jury indicted Kim, and she was put on trial for one count of capital murder for the deaths of Miss Metcalf, Miss Strange, Mr. Kelly, Miss Bryant, and Miss Few, and 5 counts of aggravated assault with a deadly weapon for the surviving victims, Miss Risinger, Miss Roan, Miss Castaneda, Miss Oates, and Miss Bradley. Now, pursuant to Texas Penal Code 1903, murder in Texas is elevated to capital murder when murder occurs under specific circumstances. So a person commits capital murder if he commits murder and the individual killed is a peace officer or fireman on duty and the offender knows that the individual is a peace officer or fireman. If the killing occurs during the commission of or the attempt to commit certain serious felony offenses. If the killing of another person is for payment or the promise of payment, both the killer and the person who hires a person to kill are guilty of capital murder. In the prison setting, murder is capital murder if any individual is killed during the escape or attempted escape of a penal institution. If the killing is committed by an incarcerated person in conjunction with organized crime, if the killer is incarcerated and kills an employee of the penal institution, or if the killer is a person already incarcerated for murder, capital murder, or other serious felony offenses. If the victim is under the age of 10, or if the individual killed is a judge or justice, and the killing was committed in retaliation or on account of the judge's or justice's service, this is also capital murder. And finally, in the case of Kimberly Science, murder is elevated to capital murder if the person kills more than one individual either during the same criminal transaction or during different transactions but under a common scheme.
In order to make it capital murder, you've got to have murder plus. You got to have murder plus kidnapping, murder plus robbery, murder for hire, murder plus. In her case, it was committing more than one murder in the same course or scheme of things. So there was only one charge for capital murder because she did commit multiple murders. Does that make sense? The other half of that is you can only kill somebody so many times. So why charge her with more than one? But legally, you cannot charge her with more than one capital. The way the charge was written at the time, all you had to do was believe she killed more than one person.
Throughout the trial, Kim's Sines seemed to be in high spirits, even smiling at the victim's families on several occasions. Sines was constantly laughing and joking with her family. She didn't seem to take any of it seriously at all.
Bizarre is a good description. Inappropriate would be a good description. She appeared to enjoy the attention being focused upon her. There was also inappropriate facial gestures. Someone would be talking about a serious matter, and she's over there smiling and laughing and almost flirting with her counsel. It was just, I think that the best way to describe it is to let pictures speak for themselves. There are photographs that were taken of her outside the courthouse, which were later published, which you would never know the woman was on trial for her life or for killing other people. It was more like, I'm at a day at the spa and everybody should pay attention.
After a lengthy trial, the jury found Kim Sines guilty of one count of capital murder, guilty of the aggravated assault of Marva Roan, Marie Bradley, and Deborah Oates, and not guilty for the aggravated assault of Carolyn Reisinger and Graciela Castaneda. It was only then that Kim began to cry. In interviews given by some of the jurors since then, it wasn't because they didn't believe that Kim Sines wasn't guilty of all the assaults as they did with the murders. It was because of the standards of justice that require that the state prove each allegation beyond a reasonable doubt. And as every juror should, in order for justice to prevail, they honored those standards. They just didn't feel that the prosecution had proved guilt beyond a reasonable doubt in those two assaults. The jury was also assigned the daunting task of sentencing for Kim Sines. So what would they choose? Would it be the death penalty? After all, it was capital murder. Technically, capital punishment is the legal penalty for capital murder in the state of Texas. And when it comes to the death penalty, Texas is no shrinking violet. In fact, in 1982, Texas was the first jurisdiction in the world to carry out execution by lethal injection. Capital punishment was resumed in 1976. Since then, Texas has executed 548 offenders. That's more than a third of the national total. In fact, over the last 3 years, under Governor Greg Abbott, 30 executions have been carried out, including the most recent from February 1st, 2018. Ultimately, the jury as a whole didn't feel like Kim Sines would be a future threat to society if she spent the rest of her life in prison. So after a long deliberation, the jury sentenced her to life without the possibility of parole, plus 60 years. Now, I asked Sergeant Abbott and Corporal Shirley what their thoughts were on the sentencing. After all that they'd discovered and after seeing all the pain she'd caused the victims and their families, how do they still feel about the decision between life without parole or death?
Kind of split on it sometimes, you know, because I know that now she will spend every waking day of the rest of her life knowing why she's there. But there's part of you that just can't help but say that's too good, that she doesn't deserve to be among us. And that may be harsh to say, but Opal was, 96 years old, you know, and one of the sweetest little old ladies that, you know, she come there to, everybody just loved to see her, you know. And, you know, she was someone's mother, someone's grandmother, great-grandmother, and, you know, she lived 96 years on this earth to go out like that. I mean, that's just not right.
Our job as investigators is not so much to determine what punishment's going to be meted out, but rather to present the information as truthfully and honestly as we can for a decision to be ultimately made by her peers. And that's what we did. I was initially very strong pro-death. As time wore on, I became more ambivalent because that was not my role. It's not my role to make those decisions. The jury was thoughtful. They deliberated long. They made the decision their hearts led them to make. I can't fault that.
Of course, the natural reaction to this case after it's all said and done is always, why? Was causing death the ultimate thrill? How do you explain Kimberly Clark Sines and what she did? The answer is, you don't.
What I finally settled on is basically whatever reason she had. But whatever it was, even if she sat down and explained it to you 100%, it's not going to make any sense to you because you're not twisted like she is. So I quit worrying about not knowing why.
We'll never know why Kimberly Clark Sines did what she did. And even if we did, we'd never be able to understand it. One thing is pretty obvious, though. Kimberly Clark Sines thought she had discovered a way to commit the perfect murders. What she didn't count on was the old saying, blood will tell, but often it tells too much. That's all for this episode of Lone Star Law and Disorder. If you have a case from the Lone Star State that you want to hear covered, whether it's big city or small town, big news or barely covered, I'd like to hear from you. For now, you can post your suggestions on Twitter at Lone Star Law Pod, or you can shoot me an email at lonelaw18@gmail.com. If you enjoyed this episode, please don't hesitate to head on over to iTunes or Google Play and leave a review. A little constructive criticism can go a long way. See you next time.